Thank you very much, Dan. I do appreciate your words and your confidence. Just reminded me of a story that my wife likes to tell. You know, she told me the other day, she said, you know, I knew you were the right man the first time that I disrespected you. Which, you know, was like a joke to us because of our relationship. But sometimes that's how we know. That's how we know God's love. And by his great patience. I have a sermon this day that I hope will be of benefit to you. It has a strange title. I like strange titles. And so I'll just go ahead and share it with you. Bad girls. You ever notice how in the scriptures there's a lot of places, there's a lot of bad girls, there are bad boys too, but we're going to talk about some of the bad girls. That were involved in the life of Christ. And one of them in the Old Testament. So, it's the ministry of Christ to the daughters of Eve. And it's a very important thing. As I listen to the... Oh, it's not on, is it? Oh, my goodness.
There you go.
Oh, thank you. There you go. Glad you did that. Bad girls. The ministry of Christ to the daughters of Eve. And, of course, you know, by... connection. It's connected to every boy too. But these are very special things. They meant so much in this time and of the world. Number one, this first one I want to talk about is Hagar. You remember Hagar? She was the maidservant of Sarah, or Sarai, maybe it was at the time, and she bore to Abraham a son. And Sarah kicked her out of the camp because of the way that she treated her, and that she was laughing at what was going on. Well, let's just read this really quick. It says here in Genesis 16, 7 to 11, "And the angel of the Lord found her by a fountain of water in the wilderness, by the fountain in the way to Shur. And he said, Hagar, Sarai's maid, whence camest thou, and whither wilt thou go? And she said, I flee from the face of my mistress Sarai. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, Return to thy mistress, and submit thyself unto her hands. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, Behold, thou art with child, and shalt bear a son, and shalt call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thine affliction." You know, first off, this is a kind of a mystical or mysterious kind of a story. It has a lot of things that we just don't agree with in this whole story that I don't like. I don't like the fact that she was pregnant. I don't like that fact. I don't like how that happened. I don't like the fact that she was kicked out into the desert. But there's some very simple, when we're looking at these Old Testament verses, we have to realize everything is about Jesus Christ. It's all a story about him. This is about him. And the story is, everything will come to the only begotten Son of God. And everyone must be subject to him and to his covenants and to his promises. There is no exception, no matter what the cost. And it was true here. It's a simple lesson, but here we see the God's love, the angel of God. He spoke to her, he came to her, and he saved her. when she cried out. What a wonderful story. And so, you know, we read this scripture that we find in the book of Isaiah, just two verses, why he does this kind of stuff. And it's not necessarily especially about Hagar, but it says this in Isaiah 63:9-10. It says, in all their affliction, he was afflicted. In all the affliction of Israel, God was afflicted. You know, he took it upon himself. The angel of his presence saved them. And in his love and in his pity, he redeemed them and he bare them and he carried them all the days of old. But this next verse is the other. But they rebelled and vexed his Holy Spirit, and therefore he was turned to be their enemy and he fought against them. Why? You know, it sounds so cruel. But why? Because there's an eternity and you must comply with the requirements of eternity. You have to get in there. So we see that he did it again. He saves her again, basically. And this was, again, after the son was born, Ishmael was born, and then Isaac was born, the only begotten son, the one to whom the promise was going to come, the one to whom the Lord was going to come. And again, they're mocking, and the son is mocking this whole thing. And the Lord cannot bear that. And Sarah is offended by this. And she again casts her out. And this is what that scripture says. In Genesis 21:15-19. And the water was spent in the bottle. And she cast the child under one of the shrubs. And she went and sat her down over against him a good way off, as it were a bow shot. For she said, let me not see the death of the child. And she sat over against him and lift up her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the lad, and the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said unto her, what aileth thee, Hagar? Fear not, for God hath heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad and hold him in thine hand, and I will make him a great nation. And God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water, and she went and filled the bottle with water and gave the lad drink. And she didn't return. And this particular incident set off the history of the world. I mean, as we know it, as we read it every day, is involved with this story, the history of the world. And we think, well, why did the Lord do that? And all these problems, all these deaths, all this hatred, all this envy was going to be there. Why did he let it happen? And I think there's probably some simple reasons. Number one, you know, look at the millions of people that have been born in this family. And they are Abraham's children. You know, I saw a little YouTube presentation by the Jerusalem Post. And they had this young man that was there. And he was previously a member of a militant Islamic group. And he was a terrorist. But he changed his mind because of what he saw. And he started preaching against it. I don't think he changed his religion, but he started preaching against, this is not right. We can't be doing this. And he has a death warrant on him now. By some mullah someplace has given him a death warrant. But this is what he made this statement. And he quoted some politician, some Arab politician. And he made this simple statement. And it's a jewel. It's a beautiful piece of gold. He said, when Arabs love their children more than they hate Israelis, then there will be hope. People all over the world realize the power of love in every form, at every station in life. Whether it's for your children, it changes the world. It can change what's going to happen in the future. Your attention to your children. And you know, that gives a lot of you, I hope, a lot of hope, because I know some of you have 4, 5, 6 kids. It's a lot of work. And God's with you. You know, there was a time in the history of Israel when Israelis began to sacrifice their children. And I believe it was in the reign of a man named Manasseh, I believe, a king named Manasseh. And Manasseh repented, apparently, and, you know, and he kind of forgave him and left his kingdom alone for a while. But God said this, I will not forgive the sin that they committed. Kids are important to God. His image. And you know, we have kids here, they squeal, they holler, they cry, they run around, they bounce off the walls, they fall off the pew. They have every kind of bodily fluid that you can imagine. They're sick. It happens all right here. You know, and there was a day when God in the temple in Jerusalem, when these little kids couldn't even get close to it. We live in a different day. It's been mentioned this day. We live in a different day. Today, we know because of Jesus Christ that he loves little children. And in that degree, in just if it's that degree, if that's the only degree, God is with us. Because he loves those little kids. What a beautiful thing to comprehend. But people all over recognize this kind of thing. But you don't hear about them so much unless there's some young man. And I'm not saying this guy is a real righteous man, but I listened to him. And some of the things he said were kind of crude. But I just picked up on this little jewel. And people do. And we have power as a people in the simplest and the most basic of human activity. We have power with God. And God told Abraham, you know, if you can find 10 people in this town, I'll spare them. 10 of you have power with God to change the fate of a city. Think about that. Love of God is compared to water, you know, and there Hagar was twice without water, you know. God gave her the water she needed. But here, let's read this in Nephi. 1 Nephi 3 and 68 and 69. And it came to pass that I beheld that the rod of iron which my father had seen was the word of God which led to the fountain of living waters and to the tree of life. Which waters are a representation of the love of God? And I also beheld that the tree of life was a representation of the love of God. The waters of life. He loved her. You know, he gave her real, literal water, but he loved this person. And he loves all these millions of people that are in the world that are at odds with him. He loves them. He cares for them. He thinks about them. He's waiting and waiting, giving time for people to come to God. And I hope you have taken note of some of the things that have come out of the Middle East and how some people are having these visions. They're Arabs and they're Muslims, and they find some little thing on the internet and they read it about Christ and they start reading the Bible. And some of them are in despair, and they say that Jesus comes to them. Can you imagine such a thing? You know, I think I believe it. I believe it. God cares for even them, but it's going to be awfully hard. You know, I had a contact in Cuba, and for the life of me, I can't get back in contact with him. He told me he had contact with some other church, and all of a sudden, all that contact's gone, but it's a communist country. They have to buy their internet. They have to go out and use it in a public square someplace, and for $5, they get an hour. And so that's how he used it to contact other people. And when he does, after a while, it just shut off. Well, I don't know. My assumption is, it's just an assumption, that the government is responsible. I don't know. Somehow, God's got to break these powers. This is what's happening in the world. God has got to break the power that keeps his gospel from going into the world. It's going to look pretty bad and be pretty intimidating. But how does he do it? You know, if there was no Hitler, there'd be no Jerusalem. There'd be no, his people wouldn't be back there. It's a terrible thing to think, but it's true. You know, he drove them out of Europe. Get out of here. I have another plan for you. It was terrible. But God has a better plan. His love is eternal. In the book of Revelation in chapter 22, verse 1 and 2, we find this same allusion to water, to this symbolic water. It says, "And he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of God and of the Lamb. And in the midst of the street of it, and on either side of the river, was there the tree of life, which bare 12 manner of fruits, and yield her fruit every day, and the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations." You know, I wondered what this was. You know, I don't know exactly what, I didn't know what exactly, but it just makes so much sense all of a sudden. The healing of the nations. You know, we started off in the garden, one people. And when we end, there's going to be one people, and the nations are going to be healed. They're going to be brought back together under the throne and under the kingship of the Lord. Bad girl number two. Bad girl number two. You remember this story? I'm going to read it. It says, "Now Jacob's well was there, and Jesus therefore being wearied with his journey." This is in John 4, 6 to 10, the first page. "And sat thus on the well, and it was about the sixth hour," which means it was high noon. "And there cometh a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus saith to her, give me to drink." You know, it's kind of an interesting thing. She's coming at the wrong time of day. And apparently, according to some of the historians, she's actually coming outside the city when there are other places to get water. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's just what I read. So she's coming out there by herself, alone, at the wrong hour. They come in the morning, they come in the evening, but she's in the middle of the day. Does she not want to be seen? That's a good question. "And there cometh the woman of Samaria to draw water, and Jesus saith unto her, give me to drink. And then said the woman of Samaria unto him, how is it that thou, being a Jew, askest drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. And Jesus answered and said unto her, if thou knewest the gift of God, who it is that saith to thee, give me to drink, thou wouldst have asked of him, and we'd have given thee living water." You know, you can't really avoid the call of the Lord. You can try. You can try and avoid it. Run away from it, but he knows where you're at. He knows where you live. He knows what you're doing. And he'll come. And he'll call you. He'll call you back to him. "And the woman said unto him, sir, thou hast nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. From whence then hast thou this living water?" So she's carrying a big rope and a bucket because there's nothing there. She had to bring it with her. This is a big job. "Art thou greater than our father Jacob, which gave us the well and drank thereof himself and his children and his cattle?" And Jesus answered and said unto her, "Whosoever drinketh of this water shall thirst again. But whosoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. But the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water, springing up into everlasting life." And the woman said unto him, "Sir, give me this water, that I thirst not, neither come hither to draw." And Jesus said unto her, "Go, call thy husband, and come hither." And the woman answered and said, "I have no husband." And Jesus said unto her, "Thou hast well said, I have no husband, for thou hast had five husbands, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband, and in that saidst thou truly." Now, today's world, she'd probably be a movie star. You know, I, I'm, you know, there are good movie stars, but it's just the fact. You get in some strange lives, and even this happens among us too. So we got our own bad girls. But she wants his water. She's thirsting for this water. And the woman said unto him, Sir, I perceive that thou art a prophet. Our fathers worship in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. And Jesus saith unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh when ye shall neither in this mountain, nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. Ye worship, ye know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. And the woman said unto him, I know that Messiah cometh, which is called Christ. When he is come, he will tell us all things. And Jesus said unto her, I that speak unto thee am he. And upon this came his disciples and marveled that he talked with the woman. Yet no man said, What seekest thou, or why talkest thou with her? Why? Because they're not supposed to be around them. According to the Mosaic law, they're not supposed to fraternize with these people very much. These are unwanted, rejected people of God's people. You know, not that that's really what the Lord wanted, but they've been taught from the time they were little. You know, watch out for this. Don't do this. Don't eat what these other people eat. Stay away from these things. And if you're not, you can become contaminated. And we'll speak more about that a little later. And then the woman then left her water pot. You know, all the work she was doing, she found something else. She dropped it. And she ran back in the city. And she said, Come out and look at this person. Come out and meet him. Isn't this the Christ? He told me everything that I am. Why isn't she upset? Why isn't she mad? Why isn't she offended? Because Christ told her. In his love, he told her. But it doesn't mean that everything Christ said didn't offend somebody, because there were things he said and he offended many people. But this person who was someone that he would listen to him, she heard that voice. And we need to learn how to speak with that same kind of a voice. So he stated here, the hour is going to come when you're not going to be worshiping on this mountain or in Jerusalem. That's really important. Jesus is outside of the wall. You have a saying among us, and sometimes we kind of get, you know, let's think outside the box. But they had a similar situation. Think outside the wall. Outside of Jerusalem. In Hebrews 13:12-16, wherefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered without the gate. Let us go forth, therefore, unto him without the camp, bearing his reproach. For here have we no continuing city, but we seek one to come. By him, therefore, let us offer the sacrifice of praise to God continually, that is, the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name, but to do good and to communicate, forget not, for with such sacrifices, God is well pleased. Outside the gate. And he was sacrificed outside the gate. A very important concept. He was outside the gate, outside of these walls, outside of these barriers, outside of these prohibited zones. And Jesus was crucified out there, and the crimson flood came down from him so that all the world could rejoice in these things. Bad girl number 3. John 8:2-7. And early in the morning, He came again into the temple, and all the people came unto him. And he sat down and taught them. And the scribes and Pharisees brought unto him a woman taken in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they say unto him, Master, this woman was taken in adultery in the very act. And now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. But what sayest thou? And this they said, tempting him, that they might have to accuse him. But Jesus stooped down, and with his finger wrote on the ground, as though he heard them not. And so then they continued asking him, and he lifted up himself, and he said unto them, He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her. You know, this story, it is a beautiful story, but let's just continue here and see if we can make some observations in this story. And again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground, and they which heard it, being convicted by their own conscience, went out one by one, beginning at the eldest, even unto the last. And Jesus was left alone, and the woman standing in the midst. And when Jesus had lifted up himself and saw none but the woman, he said unto her, Woman, where are those thine accusers? And who hath And hath no man condemned thee? And she said, No man, Lord. And Jesus said unto her, Neither do I condemn thee. Go and sin no more. And then spake Jesus again unto them, saying, I am the light of the world, and he that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. Now, I read that last verse. It's almost kind of like a part of the next story. But this is an example that we need to follow. And this particular thing is like a turning point, I believe. It's something very special about this. You know, it says that, you know, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. There's all kinds of things about what people think he wrote, and I have no proof of any of those things. But let's ask what he did not do. He did not ask for all the sordid details. He did not command the scribes and Pharisees to bring the other adulterer. He did not condemn the scribes and the Pharisees. You haven't thought about that much, maybe. He didn't. He didn't condemn them. He did not at this time say to that woman, you are forgiven. It's not written there. There was, at this particular moment, there was no opposition to what he had done. And it all ceased immediately for that one statement that he made. It just went away. In the beginning at the eldest, it says, probably because they have more sins, you've lived longer. You have more things, and whatever was on their conscience, I don't know. He touched their conscience. But what did he do? He gave her grace, his love, and he gave her time. Go back. Go back. Sin no more. You know, it must have been to her, as she was standing there quietly, it must have been to her like cool drink of water, sparking within her some kind of a hope. Maybe there's hope for me. Maybe I can get out of this mess. Well, I don't know. You know, there's a lot of talk. I've read a lot of commentaries, and I'm sure you have too, who this person was. I don't know, and it doesn't say. Some people surmise that it was Mary, the sister of Lazarus, and I don't know if it was or not. Maybe it was, and it doesn't matter. It's not really important. But here we have this progression in this next thing about Martha and Mary. And in Luke chapter 10, 40 to 42, it says, But Martha was cumbered about much serving, and came to him and said, Lord, dost thou not care that my sister hath left me to serve alone? Bid her, therefore, that she help me. Maybe it was Mary. Maybe she is the younger daughter and she's gone out and she's just messing her life up. She's never responsible. She comes back home and she's sitting here and she's still not helping me. Nothing's changed as far as Martha's concerned. But Jesus makes a statement, and Jesus answered and said unto her, Martha, Martha, thou art careful and troubled about many things, but one thing is needful, and Mary hath chosen that good part, which shall not be taken away from her. Now, you know, if that is the woman, I don't know if it is or not. But I don't know what's taking place in Mary's life, but for some reason, she wants to listen. And maybe she's at this place in her life where, you know, I need something. I need God. And she's there and she's listening and she's absorbing and she's soaking up all of his teachings and his love and his compassion and his wisdom. And she feels the spirit that he carries. And so, you know, it's not really important really who it was, because as our brother pointed out today, it's all about the Lord. Someone did in a testimony. It's all about what he is doing, what he is saying. And sometimes, you know, all of us, as we're reading these things, sometimes we put ourselves, I put myself in some of these stories. You know, I can picture myself in this same situation, or something maybe the way that I was in the past, or something that maybe I'm still struggling with. I put myself in these situations. And it's all about the Lord's response. That's the most important thing. How did he respond? And that's how, of course, we need to respond. Bad girl number four. This was mentioned today. I want to read this story in Mark chapter 5, verse 25 to 34. And a certain woman, which had an issue of blood 12 years, and had suffered many things of many physicians, and had spent all that she had, and was nothing bettered, but rather grew worse. When she had heard of Jesus, came in the press behind and touched his garment. For she said, if I may touch but his clothes, I shall be whole. And straightway the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of that plague. And Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that virtue or power had gone out of him, turned him about in the press and said, who touched my clothes? Who touched me? You know the story, it's an unusual story, but I want to see if I can add something to this. In Jewish custom, this woman was separated. With an issue of blood, you cannot go near the temple. You cannot go around men. You cannot be with your husband. You cannot, there's all kinds of things, because this symbol of death, which is what it is, a symbol of death, it's just a symbolic thing that was in the Mosaic Law. It's a symbol of death. It's the same reason why, you know, when the Jews have a practice, you know, you can't have cheese and you can't have meat at the same time. You can't have anything dairy or anything meat. You can't mix the two. It's really a simple issue. You cannot mix life and death. It's a simple thing. And it doesn't matter today. It's completely irrelevant. We know this. Their spiritual life and spiritual death cannot be mixed. They will not be mixed. And the same thing was true here in this day. And these people, they had a custom. You know, they took these ritual baths often. Some of them probably every day. They took a ritual bath. They woke up and they bathed in the morning. And after a woman's time of the month, well, she had to wait 5 days, and then she took a bath, and then she took a ritual bath, or 7 days. It doesn't matter. She had to wait. She couldn't be around. She couldn't go to the temple. She couldn't go there. She was separated. And so she's going through this group of people, knowing that if some rabbi sees her, she'll probably be chastised. Knowing all these things. And she goes and she touches his garment. And then he says, and brings the attention of everyone there to this vile woman, who touched me? And it says she feared. She feared and she ran and told him everything. And so in the Mosaic law, you couldn't go to there. But in this particular law, the law of Christ and the law of faith in him and the law of coming to him, we can go to him. She can go to the last high priest. There is no barrier, nothing but what's in your heart. That's the only thing that is a barrier. You can come to God at any time in your life. And his disciples said unto him, "Thou seest the multitude thronging thee, and sayest thou, who touched me?" And he looked round about to see her that had done this thing, but the woman fearing and trembling, knowing what was done in her. I don't really know how far that custom went, whether they would have considered it a vile thing, whether they might have even stoned her. I really don't know. I don't know how far they went with such things. But it was a serious thing, especially if they'd come close to a priest or something. It would have been very, extremely serious. But the woman, fearing and trembling, knowing what was done in her, came and fell down before him and told him all the truth. And he said unto her, "Daughter." So, what does that mean? I claim you. Daughter, you're mine. I claim you. Thy faith hath made thee whole. Go in peace. And be thou whole of thy plague. What a beautiful story. You know, these vases that they took, they had this when they had the temple, and just before Christ came, there's some evidence in history that they started baptizing, and the Essenes and the other people. I don't know how far this went, but they still practice these same things to this very day. I don't know if you know that. It's called a mikvah. And they go, and after they have something they need to be spiritually clean, they'll go, and like someone like this woman would go, and they go to these public baths. And as a matter of fact, it's so serious to them, they say, "You will make this mikvah, this bath, before you make a synagogue. You will make it. If you have no money, you'll sell the Torah to do it." That's how serious it is. But of course, they usually have enough money, so they do it. But that's their custom. So they go and they make this. And this thing is, you know, thousands of gallons big. And they have a set number of people that can go in there and bathe. And there's one for the men, there's one for the women, I guess. Or maybe in some places there's one, they use the same one and share. I don't know how that works. But they go in there and they dip down in it, and they dip down three times, and they come out and they're ceremonially clean. This is a very important thing. So this woman was isolated and separated. She couldn't go and be ceremonially clean in any way for 12 years. It is something to consider. We also read that in Revelation 4 and 6 and 15 and 2, I'll just read that. It says, "And before the throne there was a sea of glass, like unto crystal, and in the midst of the throne, and round about the throne, were four beasts full of eyes before and behind." And verse 2 of chapter 15, "And I saw as it were a sea of glass mingled with fire, and them that had gotten the victory over the beast, and over the image, and over his mark."